Okay. My name is Conley Bird, and I am definitely an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's not been necessary for me to take a drink of alcohol or any other mind-altering substance since Friday the 13th of June of 1980. And for that, I'm extremely grateful to you and most of the people in my hometown, the surrounding areas, and my family are grateful as well. I was taught you should always start the meetings with gratitude. You know, and I want to say I'm grateful to be here. Milton, thank you for inviting me. You know, I echo Gloria's comments. Thank you, you know, to the kitchen staff, to the trustees, your board of directors, you know, that keep this thing going, and to each of you for coming and participating in this process. Anything in Alcoholics Anonymous where we get together and share our experience, strength, and hope with each other is pretty amazing. I have no idea where I'm going this morning, except in a general way, I'm supposed to tell you how it was, what happened, and how it is. But one of the other things Clayton didn't tell you, you know, some of you know, I'm the immediate past trustee. Clayton's the current trustee from the Southwest region and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know, I'm going through this change of life thing, you know, and so I want to qualify so you'll know that I did indeed drink. My first drink, I was a senior in high school. There was a little gal next door that I grew up next to that I thought was the most beautiful woman in the whole world. And I had this fantasy that we were gonna someday get married and live happily ever after. She went off to college while I was still in high school and came home one weekend and told my parents that she was getting married and asked them to tell me because she knew how I felt about her. And when she told me, when they told me that, I knew she'd be in the next weekend to the Razorback football game there in Little Rock War Memorial Stadium. And I made up my mind I was going to get drunk. And I had a buddy that had a fake ID. Excuse me. We went over to the John's Minuteman, which was a hamburger joint there in Little Rock on University Street, right around the corner from the stadium. And that used to be Hay Street, so the Hay Street liquor store was right next to this hamburger joint, and I sent him over there and had him buy me a pint of black Jack Daniel's Black Label. And looking back, and particularly when I did my inventory, I realized the reason I did that was the most sophisticated man that I knew in Little Rock at the time that lived on the penthouse at the top of the rock, that drove a brand new Cadillac Eldorado every year, always had a good-looking woman on his arm, was a member of all the country clubs and had box seats at the racetrack every year. The only thing he would drink was Jack Daniel's Black Label. And in this deal, I could see that I wanted to be like him because I felt inadequate, I felt insecure, I was nervous around women in particular. I didn't feel like I fit in. I was the little ugly duckling, so to speak. And he brought that pint over, and I poured the biggest part of that cup of Coke out and filled it up with that pint of Jack Daniel's, and I sucked it down to a straw in less than 5 minutes. I don't know if you remember your first drink, but I remember mine. That was good. You don't want anybody to know it's your first time out of the box. We went over the stadium and immediately ran into her and her fiance, and I didn't want her to see me because I didn't want her to know how bad I was messing up. I didn't want her to know how bad I was hurting on the inside. And I can remember blurting out hi or something. And then I don't even remember if we stayed for the game. But a few minutes later, something miraculous happened. All of a sudden, I felt taller, better looking. I knew I could suddenly dance and tell jokes. And I could pick up women and do all those things, you know, that I couldn't do a few minutes before. And it was, I had a spiritual awakening. I had that sense of ease and comfort that comes with taking the first drink that Joe was talking about last night. And then I got worried with my lightning intelligence and whatnot. I figured out that, you know, it probably was related to the booze, and at some point later in the night, that booze was going to wear off and I'd turn back into the ugly duckling, and I didn't want that to happen. What I didn't realize is the phenomenon of craving was already beginning to occur. And so we left the stadium, we went downtown, the old train station there in Little Rock. Across the street was the Capital Liquor Store. I sent my buddy in, had him pull the money, you know, between us, and I said, bring back whatever you can. And he brought back a half pint of cherry vodka apiece. I guzzled that. And then we ended up at one of the hotels downtown. I don't know if it was the Marion. I don't know if it was the Lafayette, but it was one. And I remember it had a ballroom. It had a big swinging door on it. You know, and that swinging door opened up, and I saw a guy clean in the back room, about three times the distance to me to Bo back there. And I intuitively knew that he wanted to talk with me. Now, he and I had never met. I had seen him somewhere before. But suddenly I knew intuitively that he wanted to talk to me. So I remember going into that ballroom. The last thing I remember is those doors swinging open. Everything after that was black except something about being in a shower. The next morning, I wake up, I'm at my buddy's house, and I don't feel so good. My stomach is still heaving. My throat feels like some dog left something in it in the middle of the night, you know, a deposit of some kind, and my head was throbbing. And as Mike got up, he started adjusting the blinds, and I said, Mike, for God's sakes, will you be still? You're shaking the whole dang room. And then Mike got to talking about what a great time we'd had the night before. And the more he talked, the more I knew I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't remember anything from the point that ballroom door's open, but I didn't want to let on. I just kind of nodded. You know, not that I could have done much more at that point anyway, but what I realize now is I had experienced my first blackout the night before. And for the benefit of maybe some of you Al-Anons or other people in the program that haven't really associated with that, to me it's just like somebody took a piece of time and a pair of scissors and cut it out and then stuck the other parts together and threw that away. I have no idea what occurred in there except for what Mike and other people have told me. And apparently I got to dancing with all the gals in the room, and at some point I did some kind of James Brown routine on top of one of the tables, and you know, they decided that I was maybe getting a little inebriated, so somebody carried me up to their room and started pouring black coffee down me. Now, I don't know what your experience is with drinking coffee when you've been drinking, but my experience is that if you give a drunk enough coffee, all you really got is a wide awake drunk. You know? And then apparently they decided that I needed a cold shower to wake me up, so they threw me in the shower, and they went off to get more booze, coffee, or something. And when they came back, apparently I'd sat down on the drain, and so when they opened the door to the shower, there was about a foot and a half of water that went out in the hallway. Well, needless to say, I'd made a pretty good impression on the hotel management and a number of other people in the room, and I at that time all I could think of was, what was going to happen when my dad found out. There were too many people in that room. My dad was too well known, and I just knew it was going to get back to him. And the only person in the entire world I was afraid of was my dad. Now, strange relationship that we have, you know, and that I have an awful lot of respect for him. But at the same time, he was the disciplinarian in my home. Whenever he'd come in from work, Mom would tell him everything that we'd done that day, and I'd just line up for the licking. It, you know, it wasn't a matter if I was going to get one. It was just how many and what for. Any event, as I was laying there in that sickness, that remorse, that guilt, that fear of the unknown, my brain went back to the night before, and I had this intuitive thought, this epiphany. You know, the problem was that I drank that dead-gum rot-gut whiskey, that cherry vodka. If I'd have stayed with the Jack Daniel's Black Label, I'd have been okay. And I knew that next time was going to be different. Next time I wasn't going to drink any. And to this day, to the best of my knowledge, I've never had any more cherry vodka, unless it was in a blackout. But I had a lot of blackjack and a whole lot of other stuff, and that set the pattern for my drinking. In the beginning, you know, there was always some woman involved. There was always some sense of rejection. There was always this sense of, I don't have to feel this way. You know, I'd get drunk, show up wherever she was at, and then there'd be some scene that would ensue, depending on the cast of thousands. You know, there'd be bodyguards, there'd be people with badges and guns and those sorts of things. But somehow, at least in the beginning, I always left with her, or a better her, and it seemed successful. You know, it worked for me for a long time. And this is a progressive illness, and given the time and the other things I'm going to share with you, I want to bring you up to the end of my drinking. My last drinks. I had gotten to the point where I drank to be a part of till I was drinking to the point that I was apart from. I had isolated myself. My disease had got me to where I wasn't going out. There wasn't anybody that wanted to drink with me anymore. I was drinking at home, drinking alone, and drinking better than a quart of Jack Daniels at least every day. That I knew I had. From the bottles, but whatever I had in between, or whenever I went out on a farm, I'm a veterinarian by profession. Clayton sort of related that information to you. And as a result of that, in that time frame, getting from that first to the last drink, there was occasions where, as a veterinarian, I was able to use a lot of outside issues. And I used those outside issues to be able to keep drinking. When I would get real drunk, I could pop a few pills, snort a few lines, do a few of those sorts of things, those outside issues, and then I was good to go, and I could continue drinking and continue functioning and doing all the things that I needed to do to make a living and to service my clients and all those sorts of things. And I relate that because I'm going to tell you how it was that night that I called Robert. Robert was the guy that 12-stepped me. This program has been kind of strange for me. You know, that old story about the sort of like during Katrina where, you know, the sheriff came by and said, y'all need to get out of here. You know, the water's rising. You know, you need to leave. They said, oh, well, we're dependent on the Lord. He's going to take care of us. And pretty soon the boat comes by, you know, and they're shining the lights up, and we're on the porch. And they say, you better get out of here. The water's rising, you know. They said, oh, well, we're dependent on the Lord. And then he's up on the roof, and they come by, you know, with a helicopter, and they said, get on. They said, no thanks. You know, we're dependent on the Lord. And the next thing you know, you drowned. And you're up there visiting with St. Peter, and you're just giving him what for. You know, I don't know about you, but You know, I've always said there's a lot of things, if I ever get to that point, I got a lot of questions. Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why did these people have to suffer? Why did I, you know, do this and that and the other? And he said, why didn't the Lord save me? I was believing in him. And he said, well, heck, we sent the patrol car, the boat, and the helicopter. You know, how much more do you need? That was going on in my life, but I was too damn dumb to realize it. You know, there were people that tried to 12-step me, and I didn't relate. Doug was one of the first ones that tried to 12-step me, and the MPs had just chased me all over Fort Chaffee, and, you know, I had a bunch of outside issues on me, you know, that you didn't want to leave at your clinic because somebody might break in and take that stuff while you were gone, or while you had it with you. You know, and I was drinking, and it was a bad deal. But Doug tried to 12-step me, and I can remember Doug was an old friend of the family and was in my reserve unit. And as he was sharing with me, I said, Doug, you can't be an alcoholic. I drank like that. I just couldn't. I was getting information, but I couldn't process it for some reason. And it wasn't until I called Robert that last day. I had thrown the outside issues out. I was drinking at home, and one of my clients came by, and I got to pouring him drinks after we took care of his dog, just like I was drinking. He decided he needed to go on home because he was on a motorcycle. And when he left, I can remember taking that bottle one more time, you know, several times. I'd done the same deal. I set it up on the kitchen windowsill, and I said, surely I don't have to stay drunk the rest of my life to live. Surely I don't. You know, well, I'd been trying to quit for a while. I'd been to psychiatrists under the pretense of going to marriage counseling. I told her how much, I told her that I was using outside issues and drinking and whatnot, cunning, baffling, and powerful. This was a psychiatrist, one of the premier in the state of Arkansas, that routinely sent people to AA. But cunning, baffling, and powerful. I never told her how much, how often, or to what extent. And she made the conclusion that if you had the access I did and the problems I did, you'd probably be doing a little of that stuff too. That was an amendment I got to make in about a year in the program. Okay, so I called Robert that day. This I don't know whether that was the 10th, 11th, or 12th of June in 1980. But on Friday, the 13th of June of 1980, I called Robert. I hadn't seen Robert in about 6 months, but he was, his last drink, I found out later, we drank together, and he'd left my house, and a bunch of other veterinarians broke into his house later that next day and pulled him out and went and threw him in Joe McHugh's Serenity House there in Little Rock and sobered him up on a 30-day inpatient treatment program. But I called Robert and I said, Robert, whatever you do, please don't hang up this phone. And he said, Tommy, what in the world's the matter with you? And I started unfolding this tale, you know, and I started telling him these things for the first time to someone else. And Robert said, can you drive? And I said, yeah, and I went up to his place, and we sat down. He locked the door of his clinic there in Little Rock, and we sat and talked for 8 straight hours, and he shared with me, and he stole all my excuses. For the first time, I was in a room with a veterinarian who I know how he drank, because I used to drink with him. What I didn't know for sure was he was using outside issues, because we would, when we were together, we would drink, go into other rooms, do the outside issues, because we didn't want the other one to know, because, by God, those were illegal, particularly the way we were using them. You know, neither one of us had a script that we didn't write for ourselves. And then we'd get back together and continue drinking. And he got to tell me about that committee that was meeting in his head. And the more he talked, the more I knew he'd been exactly where I'd been. He'd been through that. But he was my Ebby. There was a light in his eyes. There was a glow to him that I hadn't seen before. And I knew that there was something inexplicably different about him. And come to find out, he had joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea. And I'd like to say I walked into the rooms, and it was, you know, happily ever after, but it was 6 weeks before I went to my first AA meeting. 6 weeks. And during that 6 weeks period, I would call Robert every day. Sometimes 3, 4, 10 times a day, 12, whatever it took, because I began to realize there was some magic that was working. When I talked with Robert, that desire I had to go get a drink that day, that mental obsession to take a drink would ease, and that hole in my gut would just kind of close up and I would be okay. I didn't have to go drink that day. And I know I've got a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous that I've never repaid. Because my telephone records in that time, it was long distance, pre-cell phone days, I had talked to him some days as much as 18 hours a day on the telephone. You know, whatever it took was whatever it was going to take. And I can remember having this dream during this time frame. You know, I had this real vivid dream one day that there were these guys from some organization that had pinstripe suits, you know, and they had Glocks and little metal things, you know, that they carried around that they flash at you, you know. And they were part of some three-letter organization, FBI, CIA, DEA, you know, ATF, you know, some one of those three-letter organizations. And in this dream, they told me that if I didn't make this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, they were going to assassinate me. And I was scared, because even as much as I'd been talking to Robert and he'd been trying to give me this information, I didn't know if I could do this deal, because I had failed at every attempt I'd tried to quit. Every attempt. I had gone to the self-help book. I knew, being medically trained, I knew that I could figure this deal out on my own, you know. And I'd been to the bookstores, and I'd go into the self-help section, and I'd buy $100 worth of self-help books at a time, and I'd bring them home like some of my pigeons do their big book, you know. I'd read two or three pages and take a drink, read two or three more pages, you know. None of them were working. Well, I shouldn't totally say that. I did stay sober one day on Robert J. Ringer's Winning Through Intimidation for about 6 or maybe 6.5 hours. Nothing was working, you know, nothing that I tried. I went to the med center and researched it, and I realized that I wasn't doing well, and that convinced me that I needed to switch outside issues. You know, I needed to go from the pills to the powders, you know, and that sort of stuff. And my life was unmanageable. I didn't know what my problem was, but my life was unmanageable. And that's how I came to Robert. And I look back, you know, and I think my life in AA, I can't speak for everybody else, but I can just tell you about my life. My life in AA has followed the history of our fellowship from the beginning. You know, in the beginning, when I got here, I wanted to stop drinking, but I didn't know how, and I was in that flying blind stage. You know, where I was throwing everything up on the wall, hoping some of it would stick. And I learned later that that's where the slogans come in. You know what the slogans are? I was taught that they were the handrails to the steps. They're what you grab a hold of till you can get your feet firmly planted on the steps and start taking those. And just like Bill and Bob in the beginning, all I was doing was what I was hearing and seeing other folks do. And I remember going to that first meeting, Robert, after that dream, I asked Robert if it'd be okay if I went up there, and he said, sure, you know. And I said, well, Robert, there's a bunch of folks down here in Sheridan, which is where I was living at the time, about 20 minutes from my home now. And I said, there's a bunch of guys here that need it, but I can't get them to go up there to those meetings. And I was wondering if it'd be all right with you and the other members of the group if I kind of like came up there and sent in and listened and came back and told them about it, you know, if that'd be okay with y'all. And he allowed that'd be fine. He was so afraid I was going to back out that night that back then we had one Wednesday noon meeting. All the rest of them were 8 o'clock in the Little Rock area. And the Wednesday noon meeting was at Joe's Serenity House. But the 8 o'clock meeting, I didn't know what time the meeting started. I just knew that Robert disappeared sometime after 7 o'clock. And he wouldn't show back up to where I could reach him on the phone till 10 o'clock. I didn't know what went on, but I had to white knuckle it during that 3-hour period, you know. And so Robert wanted me to ride with him, and I said, nah, I'll take my car. And I drove my car up there so I had a getaway. We walked in, and we got there at 20 minutes after 7, so it was another 40 minutes before the meeting started, and there wasn't but 3 people in the room. And this was the Cosmo group of AA, and there in Little Rock it was the second group that sprung off the 120 and a half group that started by Mel. I may talk more about that later, but any event, it was in the bottom of the Catholic diocese. At the time, they had these big pillars in there that were about yay big around, you know, that were holding the rest of the building up. This was in the basement. And as we walked around the corner, there were 3 guys sitting there, and one of them was pressing. He said, Clemmy Bird, my golly, we got a chair over here with your name on it. We've been looking for you for a long time. Preston had been there when the MPs were chasing me and all that. I drilled with him 1 week in a month and 2 weeks every summer, you know, for quite a long time. any event, I went over and shook their hands, you know, and introduced myself to the other 2 people. You know, this weekend, you know, y'all probably thought I was just being really nice and, you know, outgoing and that sort of stuff. But as people started to drift into the meeting that night, you know, I went, well, I just said hi to these 3. I don't know these other people, but it seemed sort of impolite not to say hello. I didn't know how many people were going to come, so I started shaking hands and introducing myself to everybody that came in. 8:05, I'm standing next to the door, and there's some 75 men. It was a men's meeting in the meeting that night, so they all knew where I was, who I was, and where I was from, Oh, Hess H. Looked up. Hess was a big, he looked like Paul Bunyan. Had the full beard, the whole thing, a big club that he walked around with. It was half a tree. What I know today is he had osteomyelitis and was in a lot of pain. But he just looked like this big bully imposing figure, you know. And he looks up at me and he says, who are you? You know, did your sponsor give you an assignment? Or what in the is your problem, fella? And I remember looking over him and thinking, my God, why are you picking on me, you big-ass bully? You know, my knees were shaking. I never said that, but my thought was, I'm going to run out the door. I don't need this. And as I turned to go out the door, I heard this voice that came from about right here behind me. And there's about the same number of people right behind me today as there was then. And that voice said, Conley, if you leave, you might not ever make it back to AA. And about that time, somebody came in, and I just reached out and I shook their hands and says, hi, my name's Conley Bird, and I'm from Sheridan, Arkansas, and I'm glad to be here tonight. And so when the meeting started, everybody knew who I was and where I was from. And it's custom of that group to ask if there's anybody new, would they stand up and introduce themselves? And as I started to get up, you know, there was a guy just close to me to you that stood up and says, my name is Hall Inn, and I'm from Sheridan, Arkansas. Oh my God, the room broke out into pandemonium. Hess laughed so hard he fell off the couch and was banging on the coffee table. He said, "My God, there's an epidemic down there. Two of them in one night." And then I stood up and I said, "My name's Conley Bird, and for as long as I can remember, I've been drinking better than a quart of Jack Daniels every day, and I'm glad to be here." And when I said that, that room broke out in applause. Now, I don't know how you were greeted when you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but the feeling I felt at that moment was, I couldn't tell you why. All I knew is I was home. All I knew was I was home. And that was okay. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic. I didn't know if I was an outside issue user. I didn't know what I was, but I knew I was safe and I was home, and it was okay, and that I didn't have to leave this group. I don't remember what else went on in that meeting, but at that night at the end, when we closed, I remember they said the Lord's Prayer, and it had been so long since I'd said the Lord's Prayer that I didn't know the words. And I remember feeling embarrassed. Cecil, Robert bought me my first copy of the Big Book. Cecil S., who's dead now, Cecil was the big book thumper of the group and had the keys to the book cabinet. And Robert bought me a book and handed it to me, and Cecil was so afraid I was going to miss part of it that he underlined some of it before he handed it to me. And he said, "Conley, I want you to take this home and see, I want you to read it and see if you can find yourself in it." And I did. I still do. That book is the most amazing book that I've ever read in my entire life. At the 2005, we were talking a little bit at breakfast this morning about the 2005 Spiritual Homecoming in St. Louis, and Clayton was the program chairman and invited me to do a little section for that. I can remember being there and hearing Clancy say that, that was the only book he'd ever read that got smarter every time he read it. But I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You know, this is an unknown fact in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can prove it to you, but I want you to know there really is AA book fairies. I know, I can see the skeptical look on your face. But I know there is, because every night when I go to bed, I got my big book there, and there are places that I got highlighted, underlined, and notes in the margin. And I get up in the morning, and during the night, those book fairies have been busy because they changed those words because they mean something different tomorrow than they did today. And that's been my experience with the book. There's something, in the beginning, I called it magical because I didn't know any other word for it. But it was magical because it met me at every level of development in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it still meets me at that. We were talking last night, this morning. I've had several conversations with some of you over the weekend, that book is so amazing because I've been in meetings where there have been professionals that were able to read with perfect diction and pronunciation, you know. And I've been in meetings in the prison system where people couldn't even read. They would stumble over the words, and yet somehow those very people who couldn't read that were stumbling over the words got the exact meaning that they needed to get out of that book to get sober. I don't know how that works, you know, other than it's got that magic spiritual fairy book dust on it that jumps off onto everybody that opens that thing up and reads it and starts to apply it. That group that I came into was a hardcore big book group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Robert and I were too close of friends for him to be my sponsor. You know, it's that old deal, contempt prior to investigation and knowing too much about a person. I knew Robert's clay feet. But they suggested that I go talk to Harry and ask him to be my sponsor. Well, when I went over and asked Harry to be my sponsor, he asked me a couple of questions. He says, Conley, he said, do you believe you're an alcoholic? I said, yeah, I'd hung around long enough. I caught this disease from y'all. I wasn't an alcoholic before I got here. I got the disease of alcoholism sitting in the rooms, AA. I think Morley made some comment about that the other night. I caught this disease sitting in those rooms. And I said, yes, I think I am. I know when I take that first drink, I can't stop till it's all gone. And I know when I'm stopped, I can't predict when I'm going to start again. Because I know I'm going to start, I just don't know when. And, you know, and he says, okay. He says, can you come to believe in me as a sponsor and follow some simple directions until such time as you come to believe in a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity? And I said, oh, yeah. He says, are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober and stay sober? I go, what does that mean? He could see my hesitation, and he said, Conley, he says, I won't ask you to do anything that I haven't done, am not currently doing, and not willing to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could envision that I was going to have to push a pencil down Main Street, Little Rock, you know, with my nose in the nude or something, you know, some kind of hazing event to show my willingness to go to any length. But he reassured me, and I said, I think I can do that. And he says, good, we'll see. He says, I want you to call me tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. Not 6:05, not 5:55, 6 o'clock. And I knew from having visited with some other people, if I called outside that window, he would say, you're too early, you're too late, and he would hang up. So I would, each morning, I would call Bethesda, Maryland, to the Naval Observatory, and I would listen for that tone. Beep, 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 beep. I'd hang up the phone and I'd dial Harry's number and start talking to him. And each morning, Harry would give me an assignment. And each day I was supposed to do that assignment, and then I would report back to him the next day. If I called in that window, I could try to reach him any other time of the day. You know, I was free to access him, but that was the only time of day that he could guarantee me that he'd be available to me because of his busy schedule. The miracle to me of Alcoholics Anonymous was A, that I realized I needed help and started coming to these meetings, that I got 12-step, that I had to call Robert, the 12-step me. Even though I had been 12-step before, and I didn't even know Robert was a member of AA. The second miracle was when I got Harry to be my sponsor and I became willing to follow some simple suggestions on a daily basis. That was a miracle. I didn't follow anybody's suggestions about anything. You know, I had to do my own thing, you know. We're close to Elvis's, you know, hometown, not too far from there anyway. You know, I was going to do it my way. But the process began. And here's what I know today. And at that point, when I asked Kerry to be my sponsor, what I entered was the same thing the fellowship did when it entered that pioneering phase, when the book was published. In fact, if you read the stories in the first edition of the big book, what you're going to see is that what they did was, because they didn't have the steps till the book was published, they just did whatever it was Bill and Bob were doing. They'd go down to the hospital, they'd go do this, they'd go do that. But when the second edition came out, okay, then they had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd had it for a period of some 16 years, and now they had a plan of action. And when you read those stories in the second edition, you begin to see the development of that spiritual program and these applications of these things into their personal programs in this deal called sponsorship. Clarence S. of Cleveland was probably the one who really originated what we think of as sponsorship today. When they were starting and they were struggling along, and Clarence was one of these alcoholics that was sort of like Bill, had a lot of ideas, you know, and was wanting to do things his way and whatnot. And they started doing those series of articles in the Detroit Free Press called Alcoholism and Mr. X. Mr. X was Clarence. And so similar to what Little Rock went through later, or actually in that same time frame, I made mention, Little Rock is mentioned in the big book in the forward to the second edition that talks about the first group that started by mail. Little Rock, Arkansas was the first group that started by mail. Howard C. had sobered up in Memphis reading the Peabody books that Bill read that helped influence part of the big book, The Common Sense of Drinking. And Clarence or Howard came back to Little Rock and went to work with another guy that he was struggling, trying to help him to get sober and couldn't. And they sent off and got a copy of the big book. And when Howard read that, he went, "This deal will work. This deal will work." And so they started forming this group. Well, similar, you know, I think we all go through this process the same way. This is why our history is so important. You know, we see the span of the way that we internalize these things. Well, in any event, Clarence and them started getting phone calls. And there were so many phone calls. I mean, it took the first 4 years of Alcoholics Anonymous when they got the book published to get somewhere a little between 70 and 100 people. And so the book's titled 100 Men, Women. You know, there was one woman at the time. In that period of just a few months, 4 or 5 months, there were 800 people that came in to AA in Cleveland alone as a result of those phone calls. And what they started doing, they would call and they said, "What do? We got all these people coming in." They said, "Well, how long have you been sober?" And they say, "Well, I got 1 day." And they say, "Okay, Milton, you got 1 day." He says, "I want you to call this guy that called, and I want you to tell him what you did to stay sober today." And he says, "Well, what am I going to do tomorrow?" And he says, "You'll tell him what you told him, you know, what we told you today." And that was the beginning of sponsorship as we know it. You know, that shared. Now, in the big book, and I grew up in that Joe and Charlie. I mean, Joe was there in Little Rock, and Joe was influenced by that A community there, and Charlie P., Joe and Charlie, the big book, and Bo's got a set of their tapes back there if you've never listened to them. Both of them are dead now, but it's phenomenal information. It's still applicable to today. And what they did was they went through this process. Well, the first everything is the nature of the problem. You know, the second everything is the nature of the solution. The second step, second tradition, second concept. 3 through 11 is the plan of action that gets us from the nature of the problem to the solution. And so that the 12s are the results of having gone through that process. Well, I got exposed to that from the get-go, and what my sponsor was doing on that daily basis, I'd call him, he'd give me an assignment, I'd do it, and then the next day I'd have the next assignment. It took me a long time to realize he is working me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. you know, it was a very hardcore big book. And Joe talked last night, I appreciate that, about the circle and the triangle. You know, the circle and the triangle is what we received in 1955 at St. Louis. And it's it's that equilateral triangle inside the circle. The circle represents the whole of AA, the whole of our world. And each of those struts, as Joe made reference to last night, on the bottom is recovery. Going up your side is unity, and the other side is service. That's the steps, traditions, and the concepts. And it's taken me a long time to truly comprehend what was going on. And I go to these groups all the time, and they say, well, we don't study the traditions. I said, really? I said, do you read the preamble? Oh, yeah, we read the preamble. Well, in the preamble are all 12 traditions. You know, they're disguised a little bit because they don't number them, but they're all 12 there. And those traditions are, you know, what steps do ultimately is they keep us from committing suicide. You know, in that recovery process, we're able to not kill ourselves. But the importance of unity is all about preventing homicide. It's what kills us from killing each other, you know, one at a time. You know, and what I had to learn, the other side, the service side, what that is the charter and the 12 concepts for world service make up the service side, and what that does is help us prevent genocide. Now, I'm going to say some things this morning that are my opinion, and it's my opinion only. You don't have to buy into it. It's okay. You know, I suggest you go home, read the big book, you know, the 12 and 12, the service manual, A Comes of Age, Language of the Heart, and a few of those other deals, and then come back and argue with me. But when you do, bring your literature, because we'll have a long discussion. Some people have participated in that. All of my pigeons today, sponsees to some of you, get taken through this whole process. I think it's important that we know what alcohol is, what Alcoholics Anonymous is, and what it isn't. And what the steps do is teach us the actions we have to take in order to get sober, to find that power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. The nature of the ones is I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. When I start drinking, I can't stop. And when I'm stopped, I can't not start. Double negatives, but somehow that's the way I have to understand it. The traditions, the first tradition, the problem is I don't know how to work well or play well with folks. I don't know how to fit in. You know, my disease is one of isolation. It will isolate me from everybody, family, friends, the world, the whole thing. It takes me out of life. And what I have to learn is how to work well and play well with folks. And what the traditions do is teaches me how not to not mess that up. It tells me the inactions that I need to take to not screw up this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the concepts, on the other hand, say there's a solution out there. The final responsibility and the ultimate authority is out there in the groups, but good luck accessing that. You know, AA is too big. It's too broad. There's too many people. For those of you, Joe mentioned the International in San Antonio, for those of you that were at the International, you know, Friday night there were some 86,000 people that went through the turnstile. Only 83 of them were registered. But 86,000 people in that room, and I don't know. I was, God knows, on Friday night, I got to chair that meeting. I looked out over that 86,000 people, and I was just overwhelmed with the size and scope of Alcoholics Anonymous. even though I'd been a trustee, even though I'd been out in the region, even though I'd been to other foreign countries, AA is just so big, it's just so immense, it's hard to imagine. And to access that, that wasn't even a tenth of our fellowship, not even a tenth of the fellowship that gathered together in that room, at that meeting. So how to access that's a problem. Well, the solutions are all in the twos, and it's all about power. I have to come to believe a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I can remember Harry, that first assignment he gave me, other than call him in the morning, he says, Connie, when you go home tonight, he says, I want you to get down on your knees, and I want you to say, God, thank you for helping me stay clean and sober today. And he says, tomorrow morning when you get up, first thing, before you go to the bathroom, before you do anything else, brush your teeth, whatever, he says, I want you to get back down on your knees and say, God, help me to stay clean and sober today. May your will, not mine, be done in all things. And I can remember saying, well, Harry, what if I don't believe in God? He says, I don't give a damn. Do it anyway. You need to practice in humility. Just do it mechanically until it comes to pass. I started doing it, you know, and all the people I've ever sponsored, I got 100% sponsorship successful rate in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm still sober. I can't say that about everybody that I sponsored, but I can say that about me because it's worked for me. When all other activities fail, work with a newcomer, you know, will save the day. That's what the book tells us. And so part of that problem, you know, so that solution, you know, is I had to come to believe in this deal. And the only thing I could believe in at that moment was I could believe in a group of drunks, G-O-D, who had good orderly direction, G-O-D, who were able to do something I couldn't do on my own. That was it. And then I got to the second tradition, and you told me that for our ultimate authority is a power greater than ourselves that can, you know, that may express itself in our group conscience, a loving God. Oh my God, now you're defining him. A loving God. Well, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I had all these conflicting ideas. My mom was from one church, my dad was from another. I got the best and worst of both worlds, you know, and growing up, and as a result, most of the time we didn't go to church. The neighbors would take us to Sunday school, you know, or Bible school in the summer or something, you know, but that was about it until my dad had this change of life experience and started going and drug us all to church. And all I heard there was this, what I heard, not necessarily what was said, was this condemnation and damnation, and that I was going to go to hell, because they said, if you thought about it, you'd done it. It was the same as doing it, and I was thinking about it a lot, you know, all the time, matter of fact. and I, in the course of my life, I broke all 10 commandments or tried to. The only reason I didn't break all 10 of them is some of them didn't die. Any event, in the second tradition, we do, or the second concept, what we do is something really unique in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm going to suggest that Clarence and them started doing it in the beginning. You know, and that is that we find a representative body, and the concepts, they talk about it being the General Service Conference, you know, that we delegate this authority to, that becomes the effective consciousness for AA, and becomes the actual voice. Well, I'm going to suggest to you that's what sponsorship is. And for those of you that have any familiarity with the service structure, I would suggest the role of the delegates is to be the sponsor to the sponsees, which is the trustees. It doesn't always work that way. Like some sponsees, they don't always get rigorously honest. You know, and if I go in and I tell something to my sponsor and I don't tell him the whole truth, then who's responsible for the results? Me, not my sponsor. You know, I sabotage myself. So we get to the threes, and the three is where we make that decision, you know, to turn our will and our life over. And I turned my will and life over to Harry as I understood him, you know, and to that group of drunks that I was with. And I turned my will, my thoughts, those things I was thinking about, and my life, those thoughts that I acted on and accumulated in the course of those actions became my life. Over the care of Harry and the group, and I began to follow those instructions. And the next thing that happened is in that group, I didn't realize it at the time because, if you asked me up until a few years ago, I would say, I worked the steps. What I didn't realize at the time was, no, I didn't work the steps. Harry walked me through the steps. And I did some action in that process. But while I was doing that, they were providing the other two sides of the triangle. They were providing the traditions and the concepts, the unity and the service. If they hadn't, the group wouldn't have been there, and I wouldn't have been able to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because I proved by myself I'm incapable of doing that. And so the third tradition is all about the membership requirement. You know, says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And we look at that and we go, oh, well, that means you have to be an alcoholic to be a member. No, that's not what it said. It said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Who gets to decide whether they're a member or not? Certainly not me. I just turned my will and my life over to Harry and this group of people that I don't know who they are. I don't know what they are. And to this day, no one has ever given me a litmus test, you know, or sat down and interviewed me to find out whether I'm an alcoholic or not. It just hadn't happened. There's no blood screen I've had to go through or any of that kind of stuff. I'm a member because I say I am, and I have to accept those. I had to accept that they were there, and not only do I not know who I need to learn from, I don't even know what it is I need to learn. You know, so that's what the group was there for, to provide that direction. And the third concept is all about that right of decision. You have to give somebody the right of decision, and for me, it was that sponsor. I had to let him make decisions and follow his directions when I didn't know whether that direction was good or not. I just did it, and the amazing thing is, when I would take those actions on a daily basis, things would turn out, and all of a sudden, I didn't have to drink that day. Every day, I felt a little better about myself. Every day I fell more in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and immediately in the fours we do this inventory. I had to do those inventories, and I've done several of those inventories. That first one I did was sufficient to get me sober. I did my fifth step with Harry, and I went home. All those things I was never going to tell him, all of a sudden, once I got through with that fourth step, I was ready to tell him. That's the amazing thing about the way the program's laid out. You take the action, and then suddenly the willingness to do the next one occurs. Up until that moment, I was not willing. But once I got it all on paper, I was ready to go get rid of it. And I remember doing that, and I got home, and in less than 24 hours, I remembered some stuff that I forgot to tell Harry that were worse than anything I had on that first four step. And I remember calling Harry up and saying, Harry, I forgot. And he says, it's okay, Conley. Write it down and we'll get together and do another fifth step. And I did. Thank God. You know, that fourth tradition, our group is autonomous. Everybody jumps on that. But it's the exception that's the important part. Except when to do so would injure them, affect other groups or AA as a whole. And so what I got to do is look at how my actions affect other groups. What am I doing that's hurting AA? Am I the best example of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous that I can be today? You know, and if I encourage one of my sponsees to come in and just say you're an alcoholic, that you've got a desire to stop drinking, they can't kick you out. You know, and he comes in, And then he goes to another group. Well, what happens? Some old-timer like Milton's going to eat him up and chew him out and spit him out, you know. And then he's going to get his feelings hurt, and he may go get drunk. What have I done to him, much less to AA as a whole? I just told him something was right when it was wrong. You know, and that fourth concept is about participation, that right of participation. And the amazing thing is, the tradition two, doesn't tell us how to get an informed group conscience, how to get that expression of a loving God. And I would suggest to you that there are a lot of times in our lives where we just make decisions, you know, but one of the reasons it's important to have a sponsor, you know, so you can bounce things off of them and get the wisdom of the group going and find out what a better course of action might be. Sometimes the good I can think of is the enemy of the best. You know, the best for me as well as everybody else. And I need that sponsor to go sit down with and have that informed group conscience. And what the fourth concept about is that right of participation. And on the big scheme, it says we need all the staff and all the trustees and directors and whatnot in the room with all the conference delegates. But what that is, boiled down to the smallest, simplest unit, it means that I got to actively participate in my own recovery. I can't sandbag my sponsor. Again, if I tell him something that's a lie by omission or commission, and he gives me counsel based on that, then I've missed it. You know, I have to take full responsibility for the results. And as the older I get in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I realize there's a couple of things that I don't do well anymore. I don't suffer pain as well as I did when I first got here. I don't have as many things to relieve that pain as I used to. I can't afford to waste too much money. Money has become a fairly precious commodity in my life as I've gone on. And the other thing, the older I get, the more I realize I can't waste time. I only have so much time left, and I don't know what that is, because each day is a gift. Each day is a gift, and the reason I'm sharing this way with you today is I feel this burden. I feel this burden for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I see us floundering out here. There are pockets of really good AA. There's still good AA out here. There's good AA, and I'm convinced, in your home groups, you wouldn't be here this weekend. There's good AA all over the world, but there's also some AA that it's what David A., who was David's gone now, he was a past trustee at large from Dallas. David would say those are BB groups. David, what's BB? He says, I don't know, but it sure as hell ain't AA. You know. I heard an old-timer down in Shreveport once here in the Southeast at the Regional Forum. We were having this big discussion about, at the time, the treatment centers and all these addicts coming in and flooding into the AA meetings. And this old-timer said, you know, as long as we stay AA, if they aren't AA, they won't stay. Whoa. I realized the whole deal of who is, who isn't, is a distraction. You know, it's something that can distract me from the nature of the solution. And that's what the fives are about. And the fives, I have to start consulting. I have to take that stuff I was never going to tell anybody and sit down and get it out, you know, so I can get immediate feedback. I can begin to hear the effective consciousness of AA working through that sponsor to give me insights into me so I can continue to stay sober. Because my own thinking is so screwed up, that's what got me here. I'm powerless over my ability to think, and it didn't clear up the moment I walked in. I'm still as goofy as I ever was. I just appear more sane as time goes on because I'm not doing as many of those crazy things because I don't choose to act on those weird thoughts when they come through that committee. The fifth tradition is all about focus. You know, it's focusing on our primary purpose. And when Harry talked to me those first few minutes, he said, Connie, he says, best I can tell from listening to your story, he says, you qualify for somewhere between 3 and 7 12-step groups that I'm familiar with. He says, but I think you're too dang stupid to work more than one at a time. He says, I think you've been overeducated beyond your intelligence. And he was right. I am incapable of working more than one program. Having more than one program going on at the same time. Now, this, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that an AA can't go to Al-Anon, can't go to some of these others. But I think you need to have a solid base of recovery before you go someplace else. You know, because it's like trying to have 3 or 4 different sponsors, you know. You're not having an informed group conscience. What you're doing is you're going, well, tell me what to do today. And you keep asking until you hear what it is you wanted to do anyway. You know, and it's confusing to work more than one program at a time. And Harry said, if you ever need to go to one of those other programs, I'll send you there. He never sent me there, and my other sponsors never have after Harry died. The fifth concept is all about the right of appeal. And what that really means is the concepts, 3, 4, and 5, are about how to get an informed group conscience. You got to have somebody guide you through the process. You got to fully participate. All the people got to fully participate. Take it to a home group. You know, when we were having, I know nobody here has had discussion about smoking in their home group. But when we had that discussion, we had these knockdown dragouts, you know, and until we came to an informed group conscience, there was always this dissension. There was always this, heck, I don't have to do what you're saying. You can't tell me I'm an alcoholic. That's an outside issue. There's nothing to do with that. But when we had the informed group conscience, we realized our old timers who had COPD weren't going to be able to keep coming back to the meetings, and we were going to lose that wisdom. And having that wisdom there was more important than what any individual wanted. That we could all do without for an hour, you know, to have that group meeting. And what that right of appeal does, it says we're going to continue the discussion until we have substantial unanimity. Until we come to a clear understanding of what the policy needs to be, you know, and at that point, we've reached a decision, a group decision that now in the sixes we have to start carrying out. And you referred last night, Joe, to the 6 and 7, those character defects and those shortcomings. You know, those are the things that I had to do the fourth step and the fifth step to find out about, because they're the things that keep, there's those blank balls I keep running into. You know, if I jump down and start making amends, you know, then what I'm really doing is I'm saying, well, I'm sorry, you know, I didn't mean to hurt you, but hang around in a few days or a week or so, I'll do it again. Because I haven't fundamentally changed. You know, the 6 is where I have to start taking responsibility for my own sobriety and my own recovery. You know, at this point, the sponsor can kind of hold your hand, but that's where you really got to start doing this inside deal, you know. And I don't like to talk about outside literature too much, but there's one piece that I think is pretty phenomenal. I thought that was a story you were going to tell last night when you talked about Sandy B. Bill P. wrote a book, actually collaborated with some 20-something people in the program at all stages of sobriety to talk about the 6th and the 7th step, and they wrote a book called Drop the Rock. It's a Hazelden publication. It's not conference approved by any means. But I think it's the kind of thing that Bill was aiming at when he wrote the 12 and 12 and gave us that other information. And I want to go back briefly to that progression. You know, as we work through these steps and we start achieving some measure of recovery, you know, we finish that pioneering phase, we get to that first year and we think, now I got all this head knowledge. What really happens at your first year is that's the point we have to start applying this stuff. That's the point where you really have to begin to, where we find out whether you really learned anything. You know, whether you're going to put this into a daily program of action the rest of your life, one day at a time, it's going to carry you through. And that sixth step brings us to that deal where we start talking about the traditions, our character defects. Bill was so afraid we were going to miss some of our character defects, he pointed some of them out. Money, property, prestige, and authority are deals that'll screw us up. So in that six, what he tells us is that we need to refrain ourselves in this cooperation and affiliation deal. A is not mine to do with whatever I want to. I can cooperate, but I can't affiliate it. I can't associate it with something because it's not mine to give away. It's all of ours, not just mine. And the sixth tradition or concept is the same way. The sixth concept, the trustees, now having had this informed group conscience, or me as a sponsee, having got the informed group conscience, I have to take the responsibility to go carry this out and do it in the rest of the world. The sevens, the shortcomings, you know, I've got to be willing. I had to do everything to this point to ask God to help me. At the seventh step, I was 20-something years sober. I'm in Oklahoma City at the Kelly Club, where they're talking about the 12th, seventh step. I look up on the wall, and it says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, I realize in the steps, it's the first time that we ask a prayer. Not a prayer that God give us something, but God takes something away, something that's blocking us from him. The same way with the seventh tradition, the way we use money. It says we're self-supporting through our own contribution. What it really says, if you think about it, is we have sufficient resources to start. We'll get more when we're supposed to have it, you know, but we got sufficient to start. The seventh concept is that deal of restraint where the trustees have to conform to the will of the conference. It says that we got these legal things that they're legal to do, but the trustees need to conform to the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's legal for me to drink in every state in the union, but our program suggested it'd probably be a good idea if I didn't do that. You know, whenever there's a conflict between traditions and legality, our traditions should always trump the legal. In the eights, we start this process of making amends, you know, and I told you that first time I said the Lord's Prayer, I didn't know what the words were, and one day I'm sitting in the meeting, we're talking the Lord's Prayer, and suddenly I hear myself say, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. What? That wasn't what I meant to say. I wanted forgiveness. I wanted mercy. I didn't want justice. That's where we start learning to forgive other people. And I had to forgive all those people that hurt me, that I had those resentments and that anger against, and that I was afraid of, and those sex problems, you know, that we found in the fourth step. The eighth tradition says, you know, now that we have this money coming in, you know, I have money, I need to not charge for what was so freely given to me. The eighth also says, except we need to pay our special workers well. We need to remunerate them well. If you have any problem, I suggest you read the long form of the traditions to truly understand them. And that tradition is sort of what we were doing this weekend when you had that tip basket out there and you put that money in it for the workers in the kitchen. You know, what you did was you learned to be generous with those people that were helping us do 12-step work that we're doing this weekend. Same way with tapers. You know, we didn't buy their equipment and bring it in here. You know, when you take their services, you're participating in the program. The eighth concept, when we have two problems, we need to divide it. At the national level, it's Grapevine and AWS. At the personal level, my sponsor told me I had problems with finance and romance, and we couldn't solve those at the same time. We need to have two different approaches. In the nines, we start making amends to those people. We start taking responsibility for our past actions. All those things that I did, I had to go out to each of those individuals and make amends, but I had to be concerned about their welfare. I couldn't harm them more by revealing something that they didn't need to know, or their spouse or somebody else. In the ninth tradition, we can't be organized, but we have these committees that are directly responsible. We serve. The ninth concept is all about leadership. And right there in that essay, Bill talks about sponsorship. You read that, he talks about sponsorship, which ties it back together. The tens are always the continuation of that. You know, 9 through 11, continue to take personal inventory and promptly admit it when we're wrong. We continue to not take outside issues to distract us from our primary purpose. We continuously balance our service, responsibilities, and authorities. And 11s, we get the payoff. The 11s are the payoff. You know, I did all this stuff to learn that I needed to pray and meditate to improve my conscious contact with God as I understood Him, to get a better understanding of God. And then I'm only supposed to ask for the power and the strength to carry that out when I leave. It's the please and thank you, if you will. We start the meetings with the Serenity Prayer. My sponsor told me that's the please. Please, God, come into our meetings and be with us in this discussion. And the Lord's Prayer, thank you, Lord, for having been here, and give us the strength to carry out what you just shared with us as we go out through the rest of the day. The 11th tradition and the 11th concept are just a practical application of those same things, and so the 12s are the results. And then those results, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, suddenly I'm filled up. I'm spiritually filled up, and now I want to carry the message to others. And I would suggest to you the biggest problem, and as I see it in AA, is we aren't filled up. Some of us are. Some of us are ready to go carry the message at the drop of the hat, but some of us aren't filled up. and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The 11th tradition tells us we need to stay in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of that. And the 12 concepts, the 12 concepts is the warranties. And in the warranties, I won't read each of them individually out loud to you, but at the last it says, we remain democratic in thought and action. What are our thoughts? Those things we turned over to God in the threes. What are the actions? It's those things we act on that become the course of our life. And Bill says at the end of that essay that what that is the quest of Alcoholics Anonymous to grow in His image and His likeness. I realize today that as we carry the message and we do those things, I'm beginning to grow slowly in His image and likeness. This is a fantastic program. The rewards I've gotten in sobriety are phenomenal. I've got a marriage, second marriage, and Susan and I have been married 29 years. And I haven't found it necessary to run around on her like I did that first wife. I've got kids and grandkids. I got one grandson that's the love of my life. Trip is a real trip. You know, he's my prayer partner. In the morning, he'll wake up next to me in bed, and the first thing we say to each other is, "Good morning, God!" And then we get on our knees, and I say, "God, help me to stay clean and sober." He says, "I love you, God." I didn't have that. I didn't have that sense growing up. What can I say? As my buddy Hall, that was there that first night, always says, "Y'all have only done one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I got here. You saved my life every single day. I thank you for your sobriety. I thank you for your patience in listening to me. I know this has been a little different talk than you normally get, but I hope as you hopefully get a tape and listen to it and play it back, that it begins to have more meaning to you and begins to impact your day.